Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. Yeah, he just told me it's going to stop any minute, and I knew it would. That's the indie disco there from my guest tonight, Neil Hannon. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. And I just thought, you know, as this is one of the longest running traditions in RTE, that this Christmas we get Neil Hannon. We'd get him back again to pick the music.
I'm a Christmas tradition.
You are. It's about time.
I always wanted to be.
It's about time. Well, Elton cancelled, actually. So anyway, we've got Neil Hannon in the house tonight, and Neil is going to pick all the music, and therefore, ergo, it will be extremely good. No pressure, Neil.
Oh, yeah. Mostly Motorhead.
So how have you been, buddy?
I've been good. Busy.
Yeah.
Like yourself, I'm sure.
Yes.
How are you, John?
I'm quite all right.
Good. Yeah. Good.
I'm already saying things like I'm quite all right. I've only been with you in your company for a couple of minutes, but I have been busy because I see more of you on Twitter than anywhere else in terms of just touring.
Which is bizarre because I'm not on Twitter.
Well, somebody is on your behalf.
My people.
Your people.
Neil,
you've been writing a musical recently.
I have. It all kicked off. Graham Linehan suddenly picked up the phone and went, "It's on, Father Ted the Musical." So that all started very rapidly, sort of once it had been decided upon.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to keep them hanging on while I finish my album, you know, as well.
I was rather upset to hear that news because this time last year, as you departed the studio going up the stairs, you and I decided to write a musical. And I'll tell you what it was about. It was about sword fencing, mostly. And the last song was going to be called "Well, Nobody Died."
I think calling it sword fencing is probably the reason I decided against it.
We'd agreed on the last song was going to be called "Well, Nobody Died."
Yeah. Which is a great idea, and we should still do it.
Yeah, but you forgot all about it and ran off.
I didn't forget about it. Right. Every now and again, it still pops in my head and think, no, that is a good idea.
All right.
Actually, I watched The Duelists the other day. Great film, Ridley Scott.
Okay, well, we'll do it sometime. Mm. So this Father Ted musical. Is it far in the distance, or when are we going to see it, or what?
It always seems to be coming to a rapid conclusion, and then something happens, and it drifts back into the distance again.
And how did you find the writing of the songs for it? Was it like falling off a log, or was it extremely difficult?
A bit of both. I enjoyed it hugely. I've still got a couple to go, it's just a matter of knowing exactly what you're writing about. And that is a bit of a problem with Graham and Arthur. They kind of go, and we should have a song here. And it's like something about, you know, Ted kind of wanting to be something. You're thinking, tell me exactly what you want. Where does he raise his eyebrow? Because you need all the ammunition to really know what to do.
And in which case, if you were given a very clear brief, could you, because it's a musical and not something for your album, can you operate at a greater speed or with greater kind of rigor in some way and just go and do it by Friday?
I am speedy, but the speed is sort of kept in check by real life. Mm. And there's always something else, you know, whether it be picking your child up from school or doing an interview with somebody. There's always something else you're meant to be doing. So to actually get in the studio, lock the door and say, I'm writing this, you know, then it happens very quickly, generally.
So in an ideal world, like some of those writers that we all know and love, you know, if you were told, look, there's something wrong, there's a problem with the music, we need a song here for Tuesday. Can you finish it by Tuesday? Can you just do that?
I'll finish something by Tuesday, okay. But I'm not always good at pleasing them.
Okay.
I have ideas in my head, you know, that maybe don't tally with theirs.
And would you be precious about what you deliver if they say it's not exactly what we want? Would you happily go off and just rewrite it?
It's hard. It's not that I don't agree with what they're saying, but it's just when you've got what you wanted to do right, it's hard to throw it away.
Sure.
Just because what you wanted to do wasn't quite what they wanted to do.
No, I saw Philip Glass on television one night writing music for a Woody Allen movie, and he arrived in with it. And of course, it was pretty good because it was Philip Glass. And didn't quite work, and he said, that's okay. Just went home that night and wrote another one. So, fair enough, you know?
Yeah, but if it's all like...
All right. So your first choice is Philip Glass. What is your first choice, actually?
Oh, my first choice is Don't Rain on My Parade, Barbara Streisand.
I never doubted you, Neil. Barbara Streisand. So maybe a little about Barbara, what the attraction would be there?
The attraction is that she's not an icon for no reason. She is one of the greatest actresses, singers, and writer-directors in Hollywood.
Barbara Streisand, Don't Rain on My Parade. Barbara Streisand, the first choice of our guest tonight, Neil Hannon, who's picking all the music tonight, so it's going to be good. You made a point there, Neil. It's an obvious thing to say, but it's actually when you stop and think about it, you said she's just the best at what she does, end of story, really.
Yeah, and, you know, I've never wanted to discount genres just because, you know, a lot of it is awful bilge. Mm. And a lot of, you know, West End stuff I can't listen to at all, you know, or Broadway. But the very cream of the crop is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there are some good reggae songs out there. I've yet to hear them, but, you know.
Neil, you'll have to come round to the house afterwards for re-education.
A reggae off.
Yeah. So, Barbara Streisand. And, of course, as a role model, as a professional, there's no better one either.
You think of what she's done. Worked her you-know-what off to get where she was. But she was also such a characterful actress, you know, and a characterful singer. And what's that, song for I Am a Woman in Love? Mm. And didn't the Bee Gees write that for her?
Sounds like one of theirs, so. Yeah.
And they were very clever in taking that sort of minor to the dominant major, which is a very sort of Jewish thing to do in music. And it really worked for her whole voice and her whole character. And that song, you know, it breaks my heart every time. And it is cheesy as hell.
When's the last time you saw Yentl?
I haven't seen it in years, yeah. But I remember it being pretty bloody good.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because that was a film that was considered a massive folly, and she put all her own money into it and all her own effort into it. And everybody was telling her this is a bad idea.
Yeah, she... first female writer, producer, director.
As far as I know,
and
yeah.
Star.
Mm. Quite something. So this whole thing about writing musicals, they're all doing it, you know. Elvis Costello's at it, and... you know, other people's work has been turned into musicals. You know, Conor McPherson made a musical out of Bob Dylan stuff, and then Springsteen on Broadway is not a musical, but it is a theatrical event all the same.
I'm jumping on the bandwagon. Yeah. No, I think I'd always, you know, from the early days, had it in the back of my mind that it was something I could do. Mm. And, you know, as much as a lot of people end up having a go, not everyone can do it.
No.
Yeah, so we'll see.
And when you were a younger person thinking this is something I will do eventually, what was just the movies? Was it the local Gilbert and Sullivan production or what was it?
I did perform in two Gilbert and Sullivan productions in Pretoria.
Did you?
Yes. Oh, sorry, Erin Royal School.
Is that what it is now?
Yeah.
I still wouldn't be allowed in. So what was it called? Which one were you in? Which one? Sorry, not Pretoria.
Oh, the two were Pirates of Penzance and HMS Pinafore.
So who were you in the Pirates of Penzance then?
I get confused, but I think I was a young woman in...
that would have confused you at that age.
Yeah. In Pirates. And then a junior sailor in HMS Pinafore. I almost did the you know, I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy, that character, until I chickened out about 3 weeks before the show. And, actually, Brian Mills, who played bass with me in early days, he did that role.
And he was
very
a
well.
He was a heavy metal act.
Absolutely,
yeah, he stripy trousers and everything.
Yeah, he was very funny.
And so when you were at school, then doing something like Gilbert and Sullivan, did you think this is really good stuff? Or was it just like a lot of things in school that sort of
forced
on you?
I was confused by it at the time. You know, I did get off on some of it, a lot of the amazing wordplay and the, you know, multiple rhymes I loved. I was always into that from, you know, the first hearing of, what am I thinking of, Flanders and Swan or Noel Coward and things like that.
Yeah,
I always dug that in a way that nobody else did.
I wouldn't have thought so. No, you know the way school, you know, the things are imposed upon the pupils in a sense. You know, this year we're doing this and the
exactly.
pupils...
Exactly,
we're
automatically meant to hate them.
And the pupils roll their eyes and think, God, this is so far removed from what I'm actually into.
And were you a childhood performer?
No, well, the first musical I was in any way involved in was a version of Jesus Christ Superstar in the school.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't bad. In fact, it was quite good. But I ended up, you laugh at this, I ended up being the drummer. Because they had no drummer. And I appeared to be the only person remaining who could actually keep a beat.
Yeah.
So I just kept a beat. I mean, I wasn't drumming properly. It wasn't even a full kit or anything, but I was the drummer.
It is the last piece of the puzzle always in teenage bands and things.
Yeah.
You know, if you can keep the beat, you're in.
But that was literally it. It wasn't even a whole kit or anything. Yeah. But it wasn't bad. But anyway, enough of this reminiscing. This could go on. Just if anybody's just joined us, Neil Hannah is my guest tonight. We're from the same town. We're not exactly the same age. Neil's a little bit younger than me. And we went to two different schools.
You are my senior in so many ways.
And we went to two separate schools for reasons that we need not get into. Reasons we need not get into.
But look at us now.
Look at us now.
Across the barricades.
Hands across the barricades, as ever. Okay. So your next musical choice, Neil, is what?
50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, Paul Simon.
Okay. See, I wouldn't have you done as a Paul Simon person, but we'll talk about that in a minute. 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, Neil Hannon's second musical choice tonight. Neil, when you were growing up, though, I'm not sure, and I'm not trying to stereotype you here, but you were kind of an indie kid, and I'm not sure you'd have been listening to Paul Simon, maybe.
No. But although I only became an indie kid maybe 86, it's amazing how you can pinpoint the year and these things back then when music seemed to change every other year.
Yeah.
And when you're an indie kid, obviously all other music goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you know, I'd gone through various like versions of myself, like I suppose the first music that I really loved was synth pop, you know, Human League and all of that stuff. But maybe I was a bit young at the time to kind of go and buy the records. And then I went through a dodgy period of like Nick Kershaw and Howard Jones and things like that, which we won't speak of. Although I still admire a lot of Nick's writing. So you might be wondering how someone who is listening to Slow Dive and Pixies kind of ends up playing Paul Simon. But I suppose you live and you learn to kind of get rid of all the fashionable baggage and all the kind of what people suppose is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was very rigid. If you're an indie kid, it was rigid. For me, being a bit older than you, if you're a punk or you're a rocker or whatever it was you were supposed to be, that was rigid too. It meant you weren't allowed to listen to other stuff you weren't supposed to. But I think people my age, again, that's older than you, no matter what they were into, in the background, there was always, whether they liked it or not, there was always Paul Simon, James Taylor, you know, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan. All those people were still so massive in the background, always there.
And you were more open to them, I think, a lot earlier on, like Van Morrison and like that.
Yeah, but it wasn't a big step. I mean, it was a popular enough, you know, it was common to be into that kind of music. Whereas I think a little bit later on, those people were really kind of seemed old, I guess.
Yeah, I've just been on a sort of lifelong journey to try and find music that is surprising to me.
Well, there's plenty out there.
Well, yeah, but sometimes you think, I want some surprising music. And you just, your mind's a blank. Like, really? I know everything. What's left? But every now and again, something comes up and you think, I'm surprised.
Throw yourself on the mercy.
Usually when I'm listening to your show, I hasten to add.
Right. Thank you. As a songwriter, when you hear someone like Paul Simon, And we were just talking while that was on. It's a kind of a complicated song, and yet you can sing along with it immediately. That can't be easy to achieve.
That is always what you're after. It's not necessarily that it has to be complicated. It's just that you're after an effect which on the surface appears just like blissfully kind of smooth, and you're not thinking about it, and people can hum and hum. But that to get that, quite often you need to put a lot of thought into the foundations, you know. And those chords in the verse of that song are not easy. Mm. I think, you know, a lot of people would think, yeah, I'll do that out busking. Mm-hmm. And then they'd look at the chords and think, nah.
And then to do the other thing, because, I mean, I started the show this evening with Indie Disco, one of your songs, which is not an obviously complex song on the face of it. And it's become one of my favourite songs of yours. And yet, you know, but I'm just, you know, at the time I would have assumed wrongly, I guess, that it was sort of a trifle or, a little bonbon.
Well, in a way, I don't, that's what I was trying to do, you know, that a lot of my songs are kind of quite throwaway. And I always think I almost have a career of one-hit wonders. That a lot of my favourite songs are one-hit wonders. That you know, you don't hear about the band before or after or the artist. And so it's getting that kind of, just that hook, that little kind of in to people's lives and characters and goings on.
Next choice. Oh, Billy Taylor.
Yeah.
Billy Taylor Trio.
I'm not really very jazz kind of orientated. I like a lot of it, but I don't know much about it. But I always loved this because it was the theme tune of the BBC film programme.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. Neil Hannon of the Divine Comedy is with me tonight in studio picking all the tracks. And, and the first time I would have heard that again was film, well, in my case, probably film 72.
Barry Norman.
Barry Norman.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was just telling Neil there that I met Billy Taylor once in Washington, and that tune came about because he was simply demonstrating to his little daughter what gospel music was and how to play the different licks. And she would keep saying to him, play that gospel piece again, Dad. And the more he played it, it turned into that. So that's basically all it was. Great piece of music, isn't it?
It is a fantastic piece of music.
Why, Neil, are you not into jazz?
I've never said I'm not into jazz. Okay. I just don't have the kind of memory capacity for it. You have to know all these names of them, like the bass player, and now he's playing with such and such, you know, and
well,
all these trios
to.
And quartets and
you
things.
You don't have to.
I have a lot of jazz records, but
that's all right,
Davis, John Coltrane.
What's wrong with that?
It's fantastic, yes. But it's a very particular sort of era I love.
Perfectly fine.
Bebop.
That's perfectly fine. That's absolutely spot on. When you were at school, Neil, you often speak very highly of your old music teacher.
Oh, Billy.
Billy, yeah, has been very influential. I don't know if I've asked you this before, but would that have involved different types of music, or was that just within the curriculum, if you know what I mean?
I think it was, you'll excuse me, the bloody-mindedness of the man. Mm-hmm. You know, that it was the complete inability to do what he was told musically, you know, or to do the thing that you're meant to do at the time. Mm-hmm. And he drove my dad mad because he was also the organist in the cathedral.
Oh, was he, right?
And he organist and choir master. And during the, oh God, I really should remember this stuff, you know, when you're going up for communion. he used to.
I thought you were going to say Christmas Day.
No.
Easter.
He used to kind of ad lib on the organ, you know, what was meant to be a really plain sort of trumpet voluntary. And yeah. Suddenly he's off into like doing Superman theme or something like that. And yeah.
But you were having all the fun across the road then.
Oh, yeah. 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 It was all, and he gave me my first big chance at stardom when I sang Pia Jesu in the Marble Arch Caves on BBC Northern Ireland.
You just brought that up boldly because I would eventually. You see, you're owning it now, because the last time I moved in that territory, I could see you starting to panic.
Yeah, I don't care. I'm too old.
There must be film of that, because I remember watching it.
There is,
yeah. I remember
in
watching
fact,
it.
They usually play it when I come on BBC Northern Ireland.
Is that right? Yeah. No, I remember, but I saw it at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
remember
yeah.
that? I mean, in those days, if the TV crew came in to Skillen, the whole town watched.
It was a massive thing.
It was a big
yeah.
deal, yeah.
You know, when Songs of Praise came to the cathedral, yeah. like, you know, who cares about what the show's about? It's like, we're going to be on telly.
On the telly, yeah. Because my mother, who was in the choir across the road, mm-hmm. they went over and sang in it as well.
Yes,
so
of
they
course.
Were all,
yeah.
there, yeah. It was that, hands across the barricades again.
We're all barricade handing.
Your next choice is hot butter.
Popcorn.
Tell me about this one.
This is officially the first synth pop song of all time. It was like
really?
Literally early 60s, and it's got an early synth, but like played in a pop setting, which it had never been used for before this.
And what had they used them for before? For movies? And
it was all, you know,
sound
just
effects
to do B-movie alien sound effects,
yeah.
really. And also, you know, your music concrete kind of vibe
yeah.
For the real artsy folks.
Yeah.
But I think up to this point, it had never really been used in a pop song. And, you know, the background is really just easy listening, but the lead tune is a classic.
And what date was this again? 1960 something?
I really should have looked that up before I came on the show.
Rough,
but I think
roughly,
it's early 60s.
Yeah. So this is Popcorn, and you reckon it's the first, one of the first, if not the first, synth pop records?
I reckon so.
Okay. Do you know, when you said Popcorn, that didn't spring to mind. And as soon as I put it on, I'm like, God, that's, that piece of music for throughout the 1970s anyway, was always
yes.
on the BBC.
Yeah,
it was the backing music to everything.
Totally. You know, Blue Peter and the like.
Yeah, magicians, yeah. mime artists, you know, football matches, the highlights, everything. That was always that.
Who was the mime?
Marcel Marceau. Yeah.
He was on everything in the 70s.
Those were good days.
The 70s were an interesting, strange time.
Mime, that's another thing that's gone out.
Yeah. Yes, and, you know, that and the Black and White Minstrel Show and other things, which few...
Do you remember that there was always a guy on television, nobody believed this either, they used to play probably that tune, actually, and he would wobble the muscles in his stomach.
Yes, of course.
He would lift up
his shirt.
The kind
of concave stomach
yeah,
thing.
And his muscles,
yeah.
the muscles in his stomach
Great
would start
days.
Throwing strange yeah. shapes.
Do you remember the guy who'd be on Paul Daniels sometimes, this Canadian beardy guy who would smoke into bubbles? As like, and afterwards they'd say, now, apparently smoking's not that good for you, so you might not want to do that at home.
Don't try this. Well, again... you know, people wouldn't believe this now, younger people, but everybody smoked on television
oh, God,
in those
yeah.
days. I mean,
yeah,
not just Dave Allen.
Dave Allen, my
hero. I bet you Dave Allen was turned off in your house.
No, my mother thought him a little too blue. But
yeah, there are a lot of Bishop jokes going on there.
I know, but I think my dad kind of had a love-hate relationship with all of that because
yeah.
he thought, you know, Dave Allen could have been my dad, you know, the way he looked,
yeah.
you know, the way he dressed.
Yeah.
And my dad had a great sense of humor, but you know, obviously there was a slight moral dilemma going on.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, Monty Python being frowned upon too. And this is not
yeah.
the life of Brian. Now. This was long before that. There
yes.
was always something not quite acceptable about Monty Python.
No, although I think I was a bit young for that. I remember one time my eldest brother, Desmond, who was 5 years my senior, kind of persuaded Dad to let him stay up for Not the 9 o'clock News.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the episode where Pamela Anderson was
well,
upside down naked. And my
yeah,
father was not best pleased.
I remember Not the 9 o'clock News was, however... It was hilarious.
Yeah.
It was really good. And
I've watched
it
since.
And the next day, everybody was doing the sketches in school,
yeah.
you know, verbatim.
Yeah.
There was another Pamela Anderson, not Pamela Anderson, what was it? Pamela, what was her name? Billy's wife.
Yeah.
Pamela.
No, you're right. It's not Pamela Anderson. That's
Pamela
the other
Stevenson.
One. Stevenson.
Yeah. That's
Sorry.
Baywatch you're talking about.
Yeah.
Much, much later in life. But Pamela Stevenson, and it was a mock of an ad for, I think, the TSB. And... Let's put it this way. It was a formative experience for anybody who saw it. And it went down in television lore as a
but
slightly,
how did you
slightly,
see it?
Slightly shocking moment. Yeah. Anyway. but it was...
it's not all the, coming out
not,
now, the
not,
issues.
Not the 9 o'clock news was really important stuff. But it was okay because she was a psychotherapist or something.
Yeah, so yeah. that's all right.
Yeah. So I think we should get back to talking about all those peculiar acts that were on television in those days. The Man with the Wobbly Stomach was one.
Wobbly Stomach.
I mean, there's probably people listening thinking this must have been the delights of living in Northern Ireland where you had the BBC.
A little bit of that.
I would have grown up watching programs like Animal Magic.
Yeah.
Johnny Morris talking to the animals.
Loved it.
The animals spoke.
And from then on, all animals have spoken for me.
In fact, the children's programs were started at 4 o'clock with Play School, but that was for younger kids. Then there was Jack and Nori, which was great.
That was a story. Do you remember Kenneth Williams doing Agaton Sax?
Yes.
Oh, that was ingenious.
Brilliant. Those were proper children's programs. not rappers jumping around the place.
Yes, Kenneth, not in our day.
Kenneth Williams reading stories. He'd just sit in a chair and read a story. That was it.
You were rapt, if I may coin the phrase.
And then there was, there would be something like Vision On.
Which would teach
you how to make things and draw things. And then there was Magpie, which was the ITV slightly cheap knockoff version of Blue Peter.
Were we both BBC families? Is this kind of what's going
on
here?
The programmes on UTV were not very good.
I just, Shang-A-Lang, even like at the age of six, I thought, that's a bit tacky.
Oh, yes. You know? And then just before the news, because the news came on at 6 o'clock, and then it was over for children at that point, because the grown-ups had the television for the news and you had to just shut up and listen. But before that, there was a short cartoon which might last about 3 minutes, and it was Rhubarb and Custard.
Rhubarb. There was also Will o' the Wisp.
Will o' the Wisp, which again was Kenneth Williams.
And Paddington.
Paddington.
Yeah.
Michael Norden.
I loved those Paddingtons.
Was it Michael Norden you call that actor? Not Dennis.
Horden.
Horden, that's right.
Yeah.
And Kenneth Williams did all the voices in Will o' the Wisp, didn't he? Or most of them?
Yeah, he did all the voices in Will o' the Wisp. And do you remember when Paddington did the Singing in the Rain?
Yes, quite beautiful.
That was amazing. And I remember going on the internet to find it when I suddenly thought, hang on, that might be on the internet now. And there was lots of people going, am I dreaming it or did Paddington do, everybody was going, where is this? I can't find it anywhere. So I haven't seen it still since.
We'll try and find that for you. We'll go
into
the archives.
Send it to my Divine Comedy internet.
I think we have possibly digressed a little. So your next musical choice, Neil, because we could be stuck in our childhoods for a very long time.
We still are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Those were the days, actually.
In our dotage.
Things haven't improved much. Rhubarb and Custard was completely out there, wasn't it? I mean, it was bonkers. Anyway, next choice is Judy Garland.
Judy Garland, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which is the best Christmas rendition of anything. It's brilliant.
Judy Garland there with a Christmas song. Neil, apparently you were asked to bring in a couple of Christmas tunes. I have an aversion to Christmas music until Christmas. It's almost Christmas now, so it's okay.
It's very much almost Christmas.
Well, it's almost Christmas. It's the 23rd of December. And I mean, are you Christmassy or is this just show business?
It always takes me a good while to stop kind of humbugging.
But now you're getting close.
Actually, humbugging would be a great name for a one-hit wonder.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's happening.
Don't get him a guitar. We'll write it.
humbugging. Yeah.
I avoid. I mean, I'm not playing any Christmas music on my show until Christmas Day.
No, quite rightly. Quite rightly.
Because you get worn out with it, don't you? Really?
Yeah, and there's enough of it when you go in and out every shop, you know, and most of it is terrible. But there are some items.
Yes, and that would be one of them.
Exactly.
Now, Judy Garland is another person, possibly a bit kind of like Barbra Streisand, who you played at the top of the programme, that if you don't actually go and listen and look, you might be forgiven for thinking, well, that's not for me. Because she's not kind of cool like Billie Holiday or something.
No, and, to many people, that kind of extreme emotionality. Is that a word? Sentimentality is a word.
Yeah, yeah.
Can be a little kind of too much. But I think when it's attached to a really, really good, honest performer, then it's great, And Judy Garland, she never did anything bad in my book.
And when she was singing that song that we just heard, you were saying, oh, listen to this bit. Now, what is it you're looking for in that?
It's the way she... there are versions of the song that don't have these lyrics, but it goes, someday soon we all will be together if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. And it's like, that is such a sad idea. And it's wonderful for Christmas because you don't always have all the people that you want there at Christmas. And kind of going to have to muddle through until, you know, these people are back in our lives. And it's the way she delivers it is like, gets me every time.
And you would have to deliver that with total commitment, wouldn't you? Because if you don't, it'll sound silly.
Yes.
Wow. Judy Garland. Now, Neil, the next one on your list is new to me. Hildegard Knef, or Knef, I don't know how it's pronounced.
I think it's Knef, okay. But I like saying Knef.
Okay. Hildegard.
Hildegard Knef.
And it's called Von Nun an Ginsburgab. Am I right?
You are right. It's an odd one. She only began singing quite late in her career. She was an actress to begin with in the war, made a few films for the Nazis, and she wasn't into it. She said that often enough. And she was actually legendary because she did the first nude cinema scene, certainly in German cinema. I don't know when the first one was in worldwide cinema. And she got into a lot of trouble with the sort of German establishment. This is like 1950. And she quite rightly said, I'm not going to take lectures from the people who made Auschwitz, you know, on taking my clothes off.
Wow.
So that was amazing. And then her sort of film career went downhill a bit, although she did have a role in Silk Stockings as the Russian kind of KGB agent, which is a huge Hollywood film. But she went into sort of writing lyrics and performing songs. And this is hopefully the German version. And it's obviously we don't know what she's on about. But I've looked at translations of the lyrics and they're brilliant. I'm going to do this song one day. I'm going to translate it myself.
And that's called Von Nun an Ginsburgab. Hildegard Knef, Neil is insisting upon. And that's Neil Hannon's choice. And Neil's going to be picking more music tonight on the programme. We're here until 9 o'clock. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Tonight, my guest, Neil Hannon. Neil was here this time last year, and we thought, as this is the longest-running tradition on the programme, that we get Neil back for more. So not only an institution, an icon, you're now a tradition.
We're a tradition. It's not just me. You need more than me.
Not necessarily a good thing, however.
No, it's just a thing that will never happen.
And we'll do it every year.
Yeah.
God spares us.
Why not?
Every year. Okay. So your next musical choice is, and this is a conversation that was had when Walter Becker died. People were coming out of the woodwork and saying, I kind of really love Steely Dan. I don't really like Steely Dan, but I kind of really love them. And I don't really like what they're about, but I kind of really love them. And this was happening all the time. So they are one of those bands, aren't they, that seem to kind of suggest a particular era and a particular approach to music and whatnot. And yet it's hard to deny how good they are.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, perhaps a lot of the people's problems with Steely Dan was, you know, to do with Walter Becker's 3-minute long guitar solos. Mm. And I've kind of learned to love them through, you know, listening, when that would be the thing that would kind of turn me off. But really, you know, what draws me to them is a combination of Donald Fagen's amazing lyrics and amazing voice and just the sublime sort of soundscapes that they conjured up. And, you know, jazz fusion chords, they're okay. They mm-hmm. can be useful, mm-hmm. especially in this kind, you know, with what he's talking about, they work. You know?
And that kind of precision as well is very hard to argue with.
Yeah, apparently, I can't remember the producer's name, but he refused to use EQs. And he didn't do anything to it. Basically, he said, if you can't record the right sound, then you're recording it wrong. You know, if you have to do anything to it afterwards, you know, you've done it wrong. Which is, to anybody in the business, that's like laughable. The idea that you don't mess with it afterwards.
Yeah.
But it's certainly admirable if that's really true.
And what is it you want? Pretzel logic.
Yeah.
Pretzel logic, Steely Dan. Steely Dan there and Pretzel Logic, the choice of Neil Hannon, who's with me in studio. See, it's hard to argue with that, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also the greatest name of any record ever.
Pretzel Logic.
Pretzel Logic. I love that.
When I started out on radio, the big nighttime radio album was Nightfly, you know, Lester the DJ, you know, and it appealed to the egomaniac. Okay. DJ in his all of an evening late at night playing this.
Yeah.
Anyway, now, your next musical choice, Neil, is the Dublin Guitar Quartet. I did a session with them some time ago. And
I bet it's wonderful to listen to.
They're really great. It's really great, actually. And it's a thing that, you know, when you and I were growing up, it was a way of playing guitar that I certainly wasn't exposed to, you know. I didn't know you could play guitar in that sort of a way, actually.
It's extraordinary what they do. And to be honest, I came at this from a Philip Glass angle. I was looking for, you know, the right bit of glass.
Yeah.
And then I heard that and I thought, that's brilliant. And it actually suits Philip Glass music, mm-hmm. you know, almost like he wrote it for them, you know.
He has bigged them up. And I think it's on his label as well, I think. It's
really?
Certainly one of the albums that they brought out was on that Orange Mountain record label. And do you like Philip? You know, you made a joke earlier on about Philip Glass.
I love Philip Glass.
You made a joke earlier on about Philip Glass. But still, I love his music. Absolutely love his music.
Absolutely. Did I make a joke about him? What was it?
Something about repetition, I suspect.
Oh, quite possibly, yes. No, there's a song on the new record, my new record, which I'm not going to tell you the title of it because it'll kind of give the game away, but it's pretty much a tribute to him and Steve Reich. Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Sorry, you've done a tribute to Philip Glass?
It's not sort of setting out to be such, but right. You know, musically it is. Yeah.
Right.
It'll all become clear when you hear the record.
And when's that going to happen?
Hopefully before the summer. Just mastered it, but you know how long these things take.
Okay. All right. Okay. Look forward to that. I am intrigued.
It's a double album.
Is it?
I know. 16 tracks.
Orchestra?
Not as much orchestra this time.
Right.
It's more of, you know, the late 70s, early 80s vibe.
Ooh. Well, okay. We need to talk when this is over, Neil. Okay.
It's too late for a guest appearance.
hand clapping. So what we want here is music from Philip Glass. This is from String Quartet number 2. It's the second movement. This is Dublin Guitar Quartet. Music there from Philip Glass, performed by Dublin Guitar Quartet from the Philip Glass String Quartet number 2, also known as Company, the second movement. Neil Hannon picking the music tonight, and what's the word they use in the music business now? Did you just tease an album? Is that what that's called?
I did a teaser.
Yes, okay, all right. So before the summer, hopefully, and you did reveal it would be a double album.
If I did it in a shop, it would be a mall teaser. That's how I got to where I am today.
That's why you get the big, that's why you get the big bucks. So before the summer, double album, and a slight kind of 80s.
Hopefully we'll get it out before the summer. I'm not making any promises.
All right.
It's quite sort of band orientated and also quite a lot of synth action going on there.
Very good. I look forward to that. Any songs about walking around in the skillin' in your school uniform or anything like that?
I'm afraid not.
That's a shame because I like those ones. I liked your early funny stuff. Actually, come to think of it, as someone who was devoted to Ealing comedies, and mm-hmm. all the rest of it growing up, it must be very gratifying to see Jacob Rees-Mogg on television every night of the week.
He's like the sort of you know, for want of a better word, villain in all of those films.
I mean, you couldn't make him up except a stuffed shirt. Oh, man.
Yeah. He just, I wish he'd have a monocle instead of like the glasses.
He used to wear a monocle when he was a child. There are photographs of him as I think of like a 9 or 10 year old. With a monocle.
And he wears these enormous double-breasted suits, which, like, come down to his knees.
There's a lot of affectation going on there.
Yeah.
Affectation.
At least he's become a cropper now.
Well, Flying Lizards is your next choice.
Yeah, which bizarrely has a minimalist connection, because Michael Nyman was in The Flying Lizards.
There you go. The Flying Lizards were, if I remember correctly, on top of the pops a bit.
They had that one real hit, which was like this, but not this.
Yeah.
They did Money, you know.
That's what I want.
I want money.
Yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah, that's what I want. So this is similar, but different, and it's hilarious.
Summertime Blues from the Flying Lizards. The Flying Lizards, the choice of... Well, that was the Flying Lizards.
Worst record ever made.
No, I love that. I love that. But what's very bizarre about it is, among many things, but the guitarist did sound like he was in another building when that was recorded. So, I mean, the idea of mixing was not really uppermost.
And it sounded like the drums were being played on an office chair.
Yes, by someone who's not a drummer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very odd, though.
Lovely.
Very odd.
Mm. But I think these things... Things like that, they kind of wash out the brain, you know, when you've had too much melody and perfect playing.
Yeah.
I like hearing things that are almost impossible to listen to.
The older I get, the more I'm listening to stuff which does not have obvious melody at all. I'm getting more into electronic music and more into kind of sort of big washy ambient kind of music like Stars of the Lid and stuff like that. I'm getting, you know, the older I get, the more. And then sometimes listening to the most cacophonic, if such a word exists, classical music.
Cacophonic. No, I think you're right. Cacophonic.
Cacophonic. that's
there was a character in Asterix called Cacophonic.
Cacophonics.
Cacophonics.
Asterisk. That's another thing that's gone out.
I know.
No.
It's all different in our day.
It is. Now, your next... I want to ask you about, you did go to Patora Royal, which is now Erin Royal
Inniskillen.
Yes. Now, among the many things it's famous for, and I know we go through this every time, but the guy who wrote Abide With Me went to Patora.
Yeah, Henry Francis Light.
Yeah, Oscar Wilde, obviously, people wouldn't know that. And, of course, Samuel Beckett.
And Samuel Beckett, yeah.
Now, Beckett was on the cricket team. Did you get anywhere close to the cricket team?
I didn't know that cricket was good. I was listening to Cocteau Twins,
yes.
And I didn't get anywhere near a sports field, let alone a cricket field.
So when did your obsession with cricket begin, then?
It began very soon afterwards, in my wilderness years after I left school. And I was... still at home, sorry parents, for a few years trying to get things started. And I needed things to do, you know, and there's nothing wastes more time than a 5-day test match. So, yeah, it was around the sort of Graham Gooch England era.
Because to watch cricket... Or baseball, indeed, actually. You really need to get absolutely into the zone, don't you? Because it takes a long time and nothing much happens for a long period
of time.
It's
really important, and it's very different from modern life.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of not... You need to leave your phone somewhere else, mm-hmm. you know, and not think about doing anything in particular. It is a bit like meditating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very healthy, and more people should watch cricket.
Did you ever listen to cricket on the radio?
Yes, it's fantastic. Test match special.
And they have tea and cake and things.
Yeah.
The commentators.
Thomas and I were lucky enough to be on Test Match Special a couple of times, amidst Jonathan Agnew and Henry Blofeld and people like that. And it is a very different vibe in that studio to anywhere else I've ever been.
Yeah.
They're just kind of always looking to kind of take the mickey out of each other. But also, you know, commentating on the match in between the jokes in the most poetic way. You know, they've got this fantastic language for speaking about, you know, what was just another ball, you know, another delivery.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
And when you made the album all about cricket and so on, that opened a lot of doors.
Which one?
For a cricket.
We made two.
Yes. Well, I'm thinking of the first one, which will live long in the memory. That one.
The Duckworth-Lewis method.
That one. That opened a lot of doors for you because you, cricket-wise, because you ended up in Lords and hanging around with cricket players and all the rest of it.
Yes. It was an extraordinary act of ligging, and I've never been very good at it, but we didn't need to try with this. We just made a record about cricket. Nobody else had.
Yeah.
So the next thing you know, we're at this, like, Times, you know, the paper organised dinner in Lords, in the long room in the MCC, with the most strangest bunch of people. There was the Mervyn King, the head of the Bank of England, and there was Christopher Martin Jenkins and various other cricket people. And then there was Barbara Sharone, who is our publicist, and also this kind of ballsy Chicago lady who happens to love cricket too, you know?
Right.
And Frank Skinner was there. But anyway, the best bit came later on. It was just as I was being taught how to spin a ball by a great spinner, and the Times journalist came up and said, "Michael Jackson's just died. We have to leave," because they were all journalists.
Wow.
And what was the most surreal night of my life, you know, got more surreal.
Well, after all of that, did you start in any way regret not playing cricket at Patora then? Because you could have played it to a decent level then. The opportunity was there if you'd been halfway decent, I guess.
I really don't feel it's my place to regret anything that's happened in my life because, you know, it's all gone rather well.
Yes, well, I do think it's cricket's loss that you weren't available to play.
Thank you for saying so. I always did think that, you know, the quick right arm spinner, you know, with the clever change of pace would have been my scene, yeah.
Yes.
But tried playing cricket since and I am rubbish. Maybe I had to start young.
I want to play one of your cricket songs.
Okay.
I like this one, Jiggery Pokery.
Was the first test of the Ashes series, 1993.
Oh, man, Jiggery Pokery there from the Duckworth-Lewis method. Neil Hannon is with me in studio. See, when I listen to that, Neil, again, and I've known you for years, and I'm still thinking, where did this guy come from?
Oh, come on.
No, but where did this guy come from? Because that's old school, old fashioned.
The subject of the song, Mike Gatting, who I was, you know, inhabiting the body of in the song. We knew it would happen. Eventually, we bumped into him at a thing, and he was very sweet. But he kind of went, "Oh, you rascal, you!" You know, because I really, you know, played up to all the kind of ideas of his that gag. Actually, I think who was it? Was it Ian Botham actually coined it? Said, "Well, if it had been a cheese roll, it would never have got it past him."
Wow!
You know?
But I met Bob Willis once.
Very good.
Yeah, he changed his name by deed poll to Bob Dylan Willis.
Yeah, he's a big music fan.
Huge, huge Bob Dylan fan.
Yeah,
and that.
Unlike Mike Atherton, who on being introduced to us said, "I don't like music."
Oh, that figures. Cricket. Who knew we had so much in common, Neil? No, for our next...
I can talk about football if you want.
Well, I don't think you're perfectly poised to talk about it just at the moment.
Oh, God, no.
Well, anyway, who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? The season
is
young.
United is a terrible
state. The season is young. Yeah. But I still think the whole Manchester United aspect to your yeah, but Arsenal, I would have thought you'd
They'd
be an Arsenal person because...
No.
But, you know, the whole classy sort of side of Neil Hannon.
Yes, but I get things done.
Old-fashioned, you know, the marble halls of Highbury, I thought, might have suited you more than sort of, you know, Old Trafford.
The Reds.
But anyway.
I don't know, it's all accidents anyway.
Well, let's not go there. So your next musical choice is actually, can I play another one of yours?
If you must.
Yes, because I want to play, I don't want people who just joined us to think that Jiggery Pokery is necessarily all you do.
I guess, yeah.
So this is one from your last album, Foreverland, which I love. And here's a song. Sometimes the last song on an album can be missed by people, I think, sometimes, because it's
I've
last song
that.
On the album.
I've often put ones I like the most at the very end, mm-hmm. and people in the business have said, "That's crazy.
Yeah.
You put it at the start." No, not for me.
Well, I... I soldiered through the entire record and got to the end.
It's good to know.
And I love this. No, I think it's one of your finest moments. This is called The One Who Loves You, the Divine Comedy from the album Foreverland. One Who Loves You from Divine Comedy from the most recent album, Foreverland. And I picked that one. Neil's here tonight picking the music, but the last two I wanted to pick. That's a great song, Neil. It really is. I know it's putting you in a spot saying that to your face, but I think it's just extraordinary.
Well, it sounds a lot better than I remember leaving it when I last heard it.
Because, of course, you obviously don't sit at home listening to your own record.
No, and we didn't play it live, so I literally haven't heard it since we made the record.
You're still enjoying the live performances, because the last time I saw you, which was last year, mm-hmm. in the Olympia, you were dressed as Napoleon for quite a part of it, and and you're playing ABBA and Dancing Queen and all sorts of stuff. You look to be having a ball. I assume that's not show business.
It depends on the show, but generally I'm having a ball because I really enjoy playing live. You know, of course there are some nights when you're feeling a little tired or something, and
you could be thinking,
I would like to be sitting with my feet up watching the footy with a beer, instead of doing this. Yeah. But then you usually get on stage and it kind of comes good anyway.
What I thought was really crazy, that particular night, I just, for devilment, sent you a text, I'd say 5 minutes before you went on, and I didn't expect for a second. You thought your phone would be packed away at that stage. You thought you'd probably be standing in the wings. And for the next 5 minutes, there was a text exchange, which literally ended with me saying,
do you perhaps need to go on?
Think you need to go on? Are you really that relaxed before a show that you could mess around with some idiot who's texting you?
Yeah, generally. Wow. It's not a lack of sort of, I do take it seriously.
Yes.
It's literally that if everything is well rehearsed and everything is in its place, then there is no reason to be nervous. And I kind of don't really get nervous. I mean, the 10 seconds when you're walking on stage is like heart fluttery kind of time.
Yeah.
But then you learn to love that as well.
Yeah.
It's like a bit of a cheap thrill.
Yeah. and then when you're on stage.
And then when you're on stage, it just becomes like the day job.
That's your room you're in then. That's your workplace.
Some rooms are harder than others.
Yeah.
Especially Clermont-Ferrand.
Yeah, well, you see, I was going to say that you have played a lot of really, really kind of fancy theatres. I mean, the London Palladium, that one in Amsterdam. I think you've played that one, haven't you? What do we call it? Really gorgeous one in Amsterdam. I forget the name of it now. I saw Tom Waits.
The Milkveg. That's the gorgeous one.
But those lovely ornate theatres, you've done quite a few of those.
We've done incredible places over the years. Actually, the most beautiful place we played for the last few years was, I want to say, it was like Milan or Turin or somewhere like that. Or was it Verona even?
Wow.
It was northern Italy, and it had, if we had anything like this in Ireland, we'd be going, this is a wonder of the world, but it's just run of the mill over there.
Yeah.
We did the Royal Albert Hall back in sort of 2005, I think. You think, how can we play the Royal Albert Hall? That's insane.
Yeah.
But then, it's just a place where people come and sit and listen to music, really, at the end of the day.
Sure, sure.
And then I stood on the piano at the end of it, and my mother got embarrassed.
That's what your mother is for. Now.
Yeah.
Now, Prokofiev is your next choice. And what is it you would like to hear from Prokofiev? Just you were saying that, it occurs to me, when I was playing I'm the One Who Loves You just a minute ago, or The One Who Loves You, proper title, I was going to ask you, actually, that how much of your music is informed by classical music, because there's a lot of strings and a lot of arrangements and so on going on.
Yeah, well, I do listen to a lot of classical music. Thanks, Lyric. For being there for me. But I also don't like a lot of classical music. I'm not madly into sort of the more baroque, classical, for want of a better word, as opposed to, my period is sort of 1900 to 1930. Mm-hmm. There's something about all of the people going on around then, the Ravel and Vaughan Williams. I'm not going to go on, but it does inform me to a degree, but I think a lot of the strings and brass techniques that I use are more from the kind of soundtrack guys, you know, like John Barry and Ennio Morricone. So I'm not going to be too highfalutin about it.
But you do listen to some of the more, for want of a better word, awkward classical music too, and more angular, difficult stuff when you like it.
Well, dissonant. The reason I love that period is because it's moving from the sort of very strict, you know, melodic things, you know, of romanticism, and it kind of gets more dissonant, you know, from Debussy through Stravinsky and Schoenberg. You know, I probably can't take most of his stuff, so that's where I kind of draw the line. And anything after the war just loses me until you get to minimalism.
Yeah,
I don't like ultramodernism. I can't deal with it. It's like, go away and boil your head, Burley. What's his name? I wanted to say Berlioz, Boulez, yeah.
go away and boil your head, Boulez. It's certainly a chorus in that.
Yeah.
What was the first line we had earlier on? Humdinger? What was it?
No, humbugger.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go.
Now that I've come to say it,
we've got it.
I've just realised what I'm saying.
we've got half a song. By 9 o'clock, you know, there'll be an album in the bag here. Anyway, music from Prokofiev, and what is it?
Oh, it's from the Lieutenant K.J. Suite, which is his great satirical work.
Okay.
Excellent.
What a righty bunch of people.
That was a particularly good recording. I'm very happy with that.
And that was recorded at Carnegie Hall, actually, which we mentioned a moment ago. Prokofiev, the choice of Neil Hannon, who's with me in studio. That was Andrei Previn conducting some orchestra.
And also one of
Orchestra of St. Luke's, I believe it to be.
My token Christmas choices.
Yes, another Christmas choice. That is, actually, you know, if you'd have said to me, you know, play that, I would have just assumed, yeah, well, that's that Christmas tune. But I wouldn't have been able to just say that's Prokofiev. It never occurred to me, actually, over the years I've known, heard that.
I know some songs sort of, some tunes, they just bleed into the background of culture and you don't really know where they come from.
Yeah, well, that's
what I've been aiming for all my life.
Well,
to write Happy Birthday, you know?
Well, dare I say it, My Lovely Horse is possibly one of those.
Damn it, it's a co-write. Damn.
All right, okay. Now, I see that your next choice is Jonah Louie. And earlier on you played Flying Lizards, but not the Flying Lizards track, the only Flying Lizards track that we know.
And I've done the same here.
And you've done the same with Jonah Louie. Are you being willfully obscurantist?
Little bit, because not only did I not choose the Cavalry one, which is the Christmas song, but I didn't even choose You'll Always Find Me in the Kitchen at Parties, which was his other one-hit wonder. And this is, I don't know even where this got to, if it charted, but it's a great song and he was really good.
I'm sorry for saying willfully obscurantist. See, if I'm in your company at all, the level rises.
I think obscurantist is definitely the name for a kind of an electronic outfit.
You know, we'll put that in the bridge of that song that we're working on slowly.
Cool.
Jonah Louie there with a Jonah Louie song. I don't know. So thanks, Neil, for that. That's a strange. It's a strange song, and
it hangs together.
It veers. I was just saying to you there. It veers between Chaz and Dave, and then something really out there. It's quite bizarre in a way, actually, isn't it? Quite odd.
It's one of my kind of one-hit wonder kind of vibes. It's just like. I'm going to do this now because I can. You know, I'm going to, Louise, I love you, I love. It's like, why?
Yes.
No reason. I love it.
But it does raise the question, and you're very interested, I know, in synths. And you use them and you have some. And you, by the sound of your next album, which you can't talk about, they will feature.
I mean, it's not a synth pop album. I'm just going to put that out there.
All right. Okay. But there's something about the problem with synths can be that I listen to stuff from back then and there are certain sounds that really don't sound so good anymore.
Yeah, and I think it
starts to fold in on itself because then there are bands coming out right now using sounds that 5 years ago would have sounded really uncool and they're using them.
Yeah. I often thought it was kind of when people thought, well, let's have a Moog solo.
Mm-hmm.
And it just turns into that kind of woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo. And it's like, no, that sounds rubbish, you know, and not in keeping. But I've always loved kind of the people who just did the whole thing, like went to town and created brilliant sort of soundscapes with all the different possibilities.
Came to it first, it was what, Human League, was it? And
yeah, although I remember I watched that sort of classic excerpt from Tomorrow's World with Kraftwerk.
Yeah, yeah.
And how so makes the drums. And I kind of had a... I remember Oxygen when it was massive, yeah. Jean-Michel Jarre, yeah. Stuff like that. But then synth pop, in retrospect, I think I was too young to really sort of know it, but that is some of my favorite music is OMD, Human League, Eurythmics.
Depeche Mode?
Depeche Mode, early Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
Not so keen on the
funny
later
enough,
stuff.
Funny enough, I'm the other way around. I like
really?
You see,
more of the goth stuff.
No, but that's always the question with synths, depending on your age. When these groups first started to appear on Top of the Pops, everything that I'd been brought up to understand about music, I was looking at them going, oh, come on, guys. You know, Depeche Mode, you know, with two fingers going, you know, pushing things. So I was very, very dismissive of
sure,
it at the start.
Sure.
But you had none of that resistance, did you? Possibly because, again,
no, yeah, I mean, I would have been 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And I thought there was absolutely nothing cooler than standing there in your leather pants,
sure.
Kind of doing the bass line on a. Mm-hmm. An emulator.
Yeah, I mean, I'm well over it now. I mean, I love that stuff, and I love those old Human League records. That don't get me wrong, we all danced to them and all really loved them. But when they're on Top of the Pops, I used to.
Well, Dare is basically my favorite album of all time. Brilliant from start to finish. And you know, Don't You Want Me is kind of thoughtlessly tagged on the end of it. Because they weren't too keen on it.
Great song.
And it's a brilliant
great
pop song.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, using synths in your own work, how do you approach using them? What do you want them to do, or what do you not want them to do, in a sense? Because in theory, you could do anything with
them. Well, I'll only use something if it occurs to me that that's going to improve the song. Mm. And so... It always comes from the song itself. And if the chords kind of suggest a big sort of string synth, that's very hard to say, then I'll do that. I've got this old Selena string machine. And the classic sound is when you put it through a phaser and it just takes you back, you know, instantly to like 1976. It's all over the disco records and things like that. I've also got a Prophet 5. Sequential circuits, and that has some of the presets on that, it's just like Japan or this record, that record, Enola Gay, and that is a brilliant keyboard. I would love to get more, if I was kind of the sort of collectory type person and I liked buying things, then I suppose that's what I would buy. But I don't really have the space, and also there's too many ponies to feed.
That's right, because your beloved Kathy takes in stray animals from all over the world, doesn't she?
She does, yes. And I look at them from out the window.
Because there are a lot of ponies.
Yeah.
Do you get involved in that, by the way? Are you out there with hay and straw and things?
No.
do you walk around?
I've never been terribly outdoorsy, bizarrely.
I could see you in a tweed suit and boots.
Well, I do have a tweed suit.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite button up the way I'd like it to, but I love animals, and we have four dogs, and you know they're my favorite people. Basically, we have long conversations, but I just don't like hard manual labor. You know, that's the long and short of it. And that's basically what she does mostly.
Okay. Your next choice in the time left to us. We've time, we'll get these in. Your next choice is what?
One more Christmas song.
Why not? Cool? It's Christmas. Last year, it was the talk of RTE, because last year when you were on the programme and I said, do you like Christmas, Neil? And you went, it's all right.
That was the talk of RTE?
Well, there's not much goes on anymore. When I say the talk of RTE, I mean the couple of people that I hang out with.
Okay, okay. Round the water cooler.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear what Neil Hannon said about Christmas? It was priceless.
We actually used it as the promo.
Well, so, I'll change my
So what's your
plea.
Next Christmas track?
It's It's a carol, but, you know, like most of the carols in the Anglican hymnal, it was arranged by Vaughan Williams. Mm. So it's automatically genius.
Now, before we hear this, I don't know if you know much about Vaughan Williams. I don't either. But I think there's this... I don't either. That assumes you don't know anything about
him. I do know quite a lot about Vaughan Williams.
You know quite a lot about Vaughan Williams.
Rafe.
Ralph, as I call him. Anyway, so Vaughan Williams... He's worth checking out, isn't he? Because you tend to hear the same music by Vaughan Williams all the time and assume that he just writes this.
Yeah,
you know,
Thomas Tallis.
Absolutely flawless, ending. Beautiful music, but a bit kind of, you know, so what really at the end of the day. But there's more to him than that, isn't there?
Well, he wrote, what, 9 symphonies? I can't remember, but there's a lot of really difficult music in there if you go looking for
it. It's not just the Lark Ascending, which is the one everybody knows.
Exactly. About, which is one of my favourite pieces.
Of course it is, yeah. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's just there's more to him.
No, I think he's...
Now that we've rehabilitated Vaughan Williams, so your carol is what?
It's On Christmas Night.
Music from Vaughan Williams.
On Christmas night, all Christmas...
Neil Hannon in the house tonight, picking the music. And again, a little bit of Christmas sneaking into proceedings. Music from Vaughan Williams, Derek Welton and Ian Burnside on Christmas Night from an album called Folk Carols and Folk Songs. Do you like, all joking aside about Christmas music, you would have been reared on carols. So do you still find them moving? And
hymns. The occasional one. It makes it harder, I suppose, when one doesn't really go to church. Mm-hmm. There's so much sacred music in their repertoire anyway, so it's just part of culture, and one can appreciate it for that.
Mm.
In isolation.
I do find, I mean, all again, all joking aside, not playing Christmas music until Christmas and Touch of the Bah Humbug and all the rest of it. When you hear certain Christmas carols, they are very, very moving. At the very least, they bring you right back to your childhood.
Yes, there were so many that I could have chosen. I love In the Bleak Midwinter.
I think that's my favourite
one,
actually.
It's gorgeous. There's also some lovely ones like I Know a Rose Tree Springing Forth from an Ancient Womb, or Ancient Womb. No, that can't be right. Forth from an Ancient Branch Tree.
Room.
Anyway, it's lovely.
Vroom?
You should check it out.
Okay. And I would have thought, again, we went to different schools, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know if you know that.
But, for instance, in your church and then the one I was going to at the same time, we'd have been singing the same Christmas carols, I'd suspect. You might have had a few real crackers that we didn't have.
Mm. And we never got to sing, you know, Ave Maria, which is a lovely one.
But those old beltery kind of real old English sounding ones, sound very English.
The old sort of Wesleyan ones. They're really amazing. And, you know, my favourite hymn has always been Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, forgive our foolish ways.
Did you record that once?
I played it on Across the Line.
On the BBC.
On the BBC.
I saw it on television.
People seem to like that.
There's a lot of blood and thunder in some of those hymns, isn't there?
Yes, let flesh be dumb, let sense retire, breathe through the earthquake, wind and fire.
Yeah, but you never did Faith of Our Fathers. That's a good one.
No,
I
don't know.
It's not a carol. We used to sing it at school you used to have mass in the gym for like, I don't know, Easter and Christmas, stuff like that. But eventually they banned it because it was such a foot stomper that the whole way through it. It ended up sounding like a Dubliners concert.
Yeah.
And it had to be cut out of the repertoire because it was provoking boisterous behaviour. But there was a lot of...
It got the blood pumping.
A lot of foot stomping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, there's some wonderful ones. What's the name of it? Cum Virgine Maria. And ancient monarchs something tree. Cum Virgine, Cum Virgine Maria.
Very good. That's the promo.
Thank you very
much. And so you did the Latin stuff as well, didn't you?
Occasionally, but that was probably just Billy McBride trying to get something cool in.
Because it was quite... I remember once being in... when I was at Oxford, right? I hastened to add, not as a student, but just there.
All right.
I happened to be...
I've been to Oxford.
I was there on May morning when they do all that
right
stuff. And it was the strangest, weirdest thing. Because... At the top of one of the colleges, I think it's Magdalen, I might be wrong, one of them, they come at dawn, the vicar or whatever he is gets up at the top and they do all this stuff, and it's all hymns to the Virgin in Latin. They're all these kind of whatever they call them in England, like mummers kinds of
like straw
all
hats
that,
and things,
Morris dancers. Complete. It's like
how fantastic. I want to see this.
No, it's bizarre. It's like it's very pagan, and it's also, even though it isn't, very Catholic.
High church Anglicanism is very close to.
But they're all singing hymns to the Virgin and worshiping the sun at the same time. It's really, really. It's really.
And then they throw themselves into the river and go punting.
That's really they had serious security to stop people throwing themselves into the river because that's what happens on a May morning. But it was quite odd because you should go to Oxford on a bright May morning because there's an old England in there that we don't see.
I'm going to do
it. And it's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Your last musical choice, Dr. Hannon, is what?
It's Les Fleurs, Minnie Riperton.
Now, Minnie Riperton, again, might be known to some people for just one tune.
One song. Yes. What's the name of it?
The one where she sings very high.
The bird song.
The one where she goes really, really high.
Loving you.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Rather you than me.
No, I can't do it. But she is a phenomenal singer. But this was kind of, there was a version of this by Fortet a few decades ago.
Yeah.
Which is a big, big hit. And it was brilliant too. And I, wanted maybe to play that. But I thought, no, let's go to the source because it is very funky. And she's wonderful.
So, Neil, I must thank you very much for coming in and helping us to celebrate Christmas.
It's been a joy, John.
How do you feel about Christmas, Neil? Do you like Christmas?
I'm dying to get it over with.
Neil Hannon, gentleman and a scholar. Thanks a million. And we're going to leave you with Neil's choice, Minnie Riperton, Les Fleurs. Happy Christmas, Neil.
Happy Christmas, John, and everybody.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.